Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Maurizio Saracini and his pioneering work have brought together the worlds of art and science. Our speaker has helped to create and now serves as the director of a new UCSD interdisciplinary department which evaluates and pursues specific research projects and which investigates not only works of art but also unexplored projects involving architectural and archaeological artifacts. It is with a great deal of pleasure that I present in behalf of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute a truly distinguished lecturer, Maurizio Saracini.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, it's a great honor for me to be here to talk to all of you and about a project that, believe it or not, it started right here at UCSD many years ago. It was, I would say, around 1975, and it was thanks to the help and the understanding and the support of a special person that is here today, and I would like to have this privilege to thank Professor Walter Monk. Well, many years ago, when I was just a kid student here, and he opened not only his house to me, but also he encouraged to move forward this very unusual field, art and technology binded together. And I must say, it's with his help and his understanding that this project was indeed, it became part of my life. I'm very privileged to be here to tell you about this quest that it shouldn't look like an obsession, believe me, it's not. Meanwhile, I've been doing other things and not just searching for Leonardo for 33 years, which is trying, for example, to study over 2,400 masterpieces so far, and then about 600 monumental buildings, as well as several archaeological sites just about everywhere. And that is, again, developing technologies and especially methodologies to do that, and to give a contribution to the understanding of how work of art was created, and also to the understanding of the decay processes associated to these artifacts. I will try to go through some of these steps. Obviously, the time is very short, and so I cannot go in depth for these different approaches in art, architecture, and archaeology, but I will try to fly over a little bit. And then we will land, so to speak, on the project for the search of Leonardo in the Holy 500. And in between, you might see a sort of a real, I mean, real-time walkthrough in a painting, as probably you had never seen before. And this is something that we have developed right here at UCSD for the first time. And it could, and I'd like to have your input after that, it could very well be the idea, or I should say, it could show the way how works of art in the future could be shown to the great public and create or an understanding, a better understanding, that is today, which seems to me is somewhat passive, how a visitor going to a museum is really posing himself in respect to the artwork. There is a lot to be uncovered behind an artwork. Every artwork has a story, a visual story that is right there, and is the story of the genesis of the painting. It's the story how it was created. And I think now we have the technology to show this, and to show even in an interactive way, as you will see later. So I really think this is the beginning, even though after 30 years, but it's always a new beginning, because this is an enormous field. There is so much to do, and here at UCSD, perhaps we could train a new breed of scientists that, with an embedded understanding of arts and humanities, they could really step up the level of conservation knowledge that we have today, as well as really show us a wonderful world that is still there to be uncovered, even for the most best-known masterpieces. Now let me just give you my point of view of how you address a work of art. We are so used to go to a museum to see a masterpiece. In this case here, you see a detail, the face of the pregnant lady by Raphael in Florence. Okay, you see this the beauty of the figure. You know that Raphael painted it. So, but do you really see what Raphael did paint? Do we really see the real thing? Or let me say, perhaps we should remember that when we look at a work of art, especially an old master, we are looking at a surface, because that's what we're looking at, which is centuries old, and therefore went through a decay state. It went through restorations. It went through paint losses. It went through additional parts, sometime added by other owners, by the wish of other owners, and so forth. So even such an important, beautiful face, this is really what it looks like today. Meaning that this is how much has been added on the surface, and this is not magic. You just shine a UV light, an ultraviolet light, and you capture with proper filtering the fluorescence being generated at the surface. And what you see, those dots, are the retouching done over tiny holes that were the exit holes of woodworms that had been eaten up the wood support of the painting, and then they just, once they got to the surface, they turned into flies and flew out. And so you first had to fill in those tiny holes with gesso and then repaint over. And then restored, as you might see here, they're tiny paint brushes, brush strokes, and then brush over layers of varnish. So this just to give you an idea that it's really not all there to be admired, and we should remember that we're looking at something so old that has been changed. And to which extent, it's up to science to show. But let's take even a more important case, okay? You know, the beauty by excellence, Botticelli, The Spring. So let's suppose now we want to see with different eyes than just our own eyes when we go to the Uffizi Gallery and we see The Spring. Let's say we would like to see the Mercury face, and that's more or less what you will see even though this was taken at halfway through restoration way back in 1980. And if you see, if you shine a light, UV light, and then before the restoration, you might see all this greenish stuff that is indeed, it's varnish, oxidized varnish. And then you see these stripes. And you wonder why, you know, you have these stripes. Where are those associated to? Well, those are, what you see here are definitely not original paint, but it's added paint, retouches. But retouches, why? Why do they take such a shape? No one will retouch, you know, in this way. Well, there is a reason, and it came out after restoration, that is, after this, this patina, I should say, and some of these restorations were taken out. If you compare the two images, you might see that those lines are even more evident, and they this time they they have a sort of a grayish fluorescence. And this because the gesso ground under the layer of paint has been absorbing the UV light. And so since very little of the original paint is left along those lines, there is a lot of absorption of the UV light along those lines done by the gesso behind, underneath the layer of paint. So in other words, what you're looking at is a damage that was done, we don't know when, to the original paint layer, because probably in the 19th century, they brushed on solvent, which it was too strong. And so you see the brush strokes, but unfortunately that solvent was not diluted enough and ate it up, literally, in other words, dissolved, actually, it should be more proper to say, dissolved the binding media, in this case the protein, egg protein, and so it left these marks as if the painting, the original paint layer, was removed, or at least partly removed. Because if we were to see this, hardly we will appreciate this damage. So this again is the spring by Botticelli, okay? So not even the most acclaimed masterpiece of the Renaissance, as you see, is the way we see it. Okay? So that also should make us think how fast and how much this wonderful art pieces are going through a decay process. And science, not only it's good to reveal them, but also to suggest, let's say, using a medical term, cures for them. And this is should not be left only to restorers with their very good hands and their experience, but like in surgery, medicine, the surgeon, the restorer, should be with scientists, in this case colleagues, surgeons or doctors, who will provide in real time why the restorer, in this case, let's go back to art, is restoring the necessary objective understanding of what his hands, the restorer's hands, are doing on the surface. Let's remember, when we talk about a paint layer, we talk about a few microns, sometimes 30 microns, 20 microns. So to expect that a human hand could have that type of sensitivity, to be so subtle, to know exactly when to stop, it's, to say the least, when we think about it, it's not feasible. It's not humanly possible. So the best that a restorer can do is try to do the least damage. But the moment he's using his hands with no control whatsoever given from science, by science, well, it could happen, let's say. And I want to give you one more example, and then we'll see some brighter side of our cultural heritage. Okay, Last Supper. I had the privilege to work an endless number of times on the Last Supper, trying always to show, to be careful, not to, perhaps we did not know enough, I'm talking about the early 80s, about how to go by and restore it. Maybe the risk was too high. I'll give an example. This is a very small detail. It's about 5 by 7 centimeters, so very small detail of the Last Supper, okay? And you might see, you know, this is a different way to see the Last Supper, okay? You really go very close, and you see that was before restoration, a surface that, to say the least, is far from being readable and to be homogeneous or to be intact. It would be, if I were to ask even myself, how can you tell what is Leonardo and what has been added? It sounds to me that it would be pretty difficult to be sure. You might guess. And then let's suppose we were to ask a restorer, okay, you decide what is Leonardo, what is not, and then you take out what is not by Leonardo, because this is exactly what happened for 20 years. That's how long the restoration lasted. Well, then you might say, wait, is that all was done? Well, Unfortunately, there was not an equipe of scientists next to the restorer to provide the restorer with objective information every single day. Well, I'll give you one more example, and you'll see how difficult that is. I mean, each just particle that of that heterogeneous surface could be Leonardo, could not be, could be restoration put on top. When do you stop? How can you tell? Just leave it only to the eyesight. To my understanding, it's a little too risky. But believe it or not, it's still the trend among restoration. Let's give you another approach to the supper and see these two images. One is just a detail, again, before restoration. The other one is a what is called pseudocolor infrared image. In other words, this time you try to go a little inside, a little through, because some of the paint becomes transparent in the infrared region, and to take a picture using, therefore, not the spectral range of the visible, that is what we can see with our eyes, but we go a little to the right in the near infrared region, and we take a picture, and there are pseudocolors because when I did it at that time, there was a film, an infrared, color infrared film, and it had the same three layers of film, but gelatin, but not. It was the blue layer was missing, and so we had the green, the red, and the infrared. So the colors that will be they were generated, therefore, were not true colors. But why do I tell you that? If we are looking at the shoulder, both shoulders actually, at the gown, if you wish, of this apostle, you might see that it looks blue, but indeed, in the pseudocolor, you have a red shoulder, his left shoulder becomes red, and the rest of the robe remains blue. Why is that? Well, that's the reason why we took pseudocolor infrared imaging, because we can have a selection of pigments which take different colors when viewed at this wavelength, or at least they take pseudocolors, and that's a way to optimize the difference in a surface that looks the same. In other words, the blue of the coat was not done with just one color; was done with two colors. The red being lapis lazuli, and the blue being azurite. So this is a very easy, straightforward way to have, even though it's a qualitative information, but yet to give you an idea. Now, why do I show you this? Because it tells you how the eye can be really misled just looking at the surface that appears in the visible of the same color, but it's not. So how would you tell? And how can you be sure that, let's say, which of the two could be it or is or was original? Maybe both were original, but at least the first thing you should do is just make aware that other modification could have taken place and you were not aware of. And don't trust your eyes either, judging colors. As we know, the color, as the colors as we see it, is very subjective. Well, as I said, it's not all bad, and I don't want to sound pessimistic about the approach and how to improve our understanding of works of arts. So let's move to something more pleasant and more interesting, if you wish, with a little less of technology behind. And let's take this painting, a Flemish painter, as anybody could see it. Now, It did have an attribution, and good for the art historian that the attribution was confirmed. And what you see here is not a game, it's not a gimmick, it's actually an image, an infrared image, this time without adding pseudocolors, of what is under the paint. Let me go back. In this area here, indeed, there is a signature. Actually, it's more than a signature, there is a date. And it says also where the painting was done, in Roma, in 1655, the 10th of August. Okay, so this is still there, has been covered. And simply using an infrared camera in this case, you need a longer wavelength to go through more thickness of paint and different colors as well. Then that's how you can get in real time on a monitor screen what could be a very important feature of this painting. As well as we should now be prepared, and I guess throughout my professional life at this time, I'm not surprised anymore. Even studying masterpieces, you find discoveries one after the other that not necessarily are in line with what we know about those masterpieces. So let's take the lady with the unicorn. The unicorn, okay? Well, all the symbolism that is related to this figure here, we call it the Lady of the Unicorn. Raphael, the Lady of the Unicorn. It's in everybody, I mean, in any art history book. But it's really so. Well, if we take an X-ray, the unicorn will turn out to be a puppy dog. Okay? And then if we want to go farther down the line, which means to go farther inside the painting, it will come out that Raphael never painted it, not even a dog. Actually left the painting unfinished. There was no animal whatsoever. There were no even hands. So up to the waistline, or I should say from the waistline down, including the unicorn, that painting was left unfinished. And the columns were also added later, and so forth. So it doesn't destroy our appreciation for a masterpiece, but science can provide you with some objective understanding, which will put you in a position to better appreciate what you're looking at. Just recently, 2006, with a team of young graduate students from UCSD, we had the privilege to study the Annunciation of Leonardo. Okay, so this was a very special event for me to have the students brought to Florence, and we were given the permission to study the Annunciation. It doesn't happen every day, believe me. It's not so easy to really have such a masterpiece just for you to study. This is not something you can do in your lab, but you create a lab around the painting, whatever that painting is. That's another feature of technology that we are pushing forward. So, I give you just a couple of examples of some of the results. You see the profile of the angel and the X-ray underneath. It will show that there is a different profile because there was indeed a change. And this is the original profile, by the way. And this is one internally is the one that is now visible. So if we are going to place one next to the other, it might become much simpler to understand what is there to be known. That is, there has been a significant change in the layout of the head of the angel. I could be more specific, but probably that will require much more time to show you that what is called the opacity, or I should say the X-ray absorption, of this part of the forehead when compared to this one here is totally different. In other words, this is whitish, this is more grayish, and this is due to the amount of white lead that was used to paint. So it's not only a shift of the forehead, but it's also an amount of paint and also how the paint was mixed, and therefore the percentage of the paint mixed with the binding media, which therefore it could indicate, we are in the process of studying the data. I mean, we brought in a real large quantity of data about this painting, that it might be not only two moments, but maybe two hands. But let's not go too far. Let's see another detail of, in this case, of the gown of the Madonna. That's the way we see it. And then this is a pseudo-color, and again you see it becomes red because that gown was painted with lapis lazuli. But if we go further down inside and we skip the pseudocolor, then we'll see these beautiful lines, and that's the underdrawing of the folds done by the artist himself. Okay? So we are able to go back, to go inside, out all the way to the ground layer on top over which the artist drew the drawing. And this is there to be seen. It's a part of the genesis of the painting. And this is when the artist really, we know for sure, it was his work, his hands. Where we are not never sure if what we see at the final stage, it was only his work or maybe his work with helpers. Because after all, these masterpieces were made in a workshop. And the master obviously never worked by himself. So this just to give you an idea how much we can retrieve of what is still there. And remember, we're talking about very few microns. Okay, I told you that we were going to have a sort of a live show, and it's about the Adoration of Magi. This is it's the biggest painting, by the way, movable object on wood, made out of 10 planks of poplar assembled together vertically, made by Leonardo. And that was made in 1478. And the approach I gave it to this study, and it was amazing when I couldn't believe that I was given this opportunity to study this masterpiece, and that was in 2003. I just followed the same approach as a doctor would follow for a real patient. So you have the anamnesis, which is the art history research, through the documents, archive documents, the critical fortune, that is the history of all the different attributions, the iconography and iconology, and obviously all the bibliography search necessary to understand the past of this painting, to understand as much as possible what was done after Leonardo to this painting, and possibly also to understand if anybody wrote about the former state of conservation of this painting. And then the diagnostic imaging. Here are just some of the exams we went through, just like a doctor would do. And then based on the results of the reading of the diagnostic imaging, then we were allowed to do biopsies. Or if you want, let's call it in our field, they're called samples taking, and cross-section of those samples were made. And then using electron microscopy, XRF, microRayman, gas chromatography, and so forth, we were able to go down to each of those layers and understand what is there and how Leonardo executed his masterpiece. So characterizations of materials, down to the microns. So I told you about the imaging, the diagnostic imaging. I just want to show you visually what I'm talking about. It's like slicing the painting, in a way, using different wavelengths, and you go from the visible all the way to the 3D model. We build up a 3D model with a precision of a fourth of a millimeter. It was never done before. Nobody ever thought that there was some sense of creating a 3D model of a work of art, but it's very important if you make it very precise, because in time, then you can compare if there has been some motion, there has been some change, there has been some structural change, and you also can not only measure it, but also identify where that happened. And so here are just some of the wavelengths and therefore the different images that we have built up. And then we've done something that in medicine has not been done yet, and that is taking the different images created with different technologies and refer them to the same geometry so that you can overlap one on top of the other, and then you can just go in and out and choose at which depth to stop and therefore to see, and therefore understanding the visual genesis of the painting from the ground layer all the way to the surface. What you're going to see is it's a simple, instinctive way to relate with a work of art. When you go to a museum, you tend to get closer to the object just to see a little better, okay? Nothing more. But in this simple movement, if we introduce science, I should say technology in this case, and we make it therefore interactive to our body motion, then what we can uncover, it's amazing. And what you are going to see is what is under the brown color, the monochrome color that today is visible on the surface of the Adoration of Mother Magi. And the way we gather that information, that visual information, is using an infrared camera that we made and operates in the spectral range of the middle infrared. So a little more penetrating than what you have seen with the pseudocolor before, okay? And then we have taken hundreds, actually 2,400 images. We assemble all together and we paste them just behind this image. And now you're going to see what we can see. First of all, as you can see, obviously we can zoom in and see details that simply will be impossible for us to see. But we want to start from the top left. Could you go up to the staircase? The way you see it today, it looks like a sort of a faded brownish surface, and especially on the staircase, what you see is there are a couple of fellows sitting down, and some others there downstairs sort of trying to interact with this guy that is turning his head and looking up, and you see ruins, basically. What was the message then? What was the iconology behind it? Well, the message was, at least up to now, let me say up to now, that Leonardo wanted to depict a desperation in the world, a world in ruins, waiting for the coming of the new baby Christ. And so there was desperation and hope, but really it was a passive attitude. In other words, manhood were just sitting and waiting for something to happen and around the destruction all around them. But let's see now, looking at the real Leonardo, and when I mean real Leonardo, at the work, the drawing that he made, things will become totally different. So now all he does is walk slowly toward the painting as he would do. But this is what you see now. Now that is the drawing that Leonardo didn't execute, that has never been seen for 500 years. And you can see that the message, the iconology, not only the iconography, is totally different. You see a lot of laymen. They are reconstructing out of the ruins of that temple. There is a message of motion, of initiative, of let's say positive sense of belief, and all this waiting for Christ to come. And in addition, you know, all the details, incredible details. Those are, in real size, they're about this tall, okay? So not only we were able to see them, but you see what kind of magnification. And you can see that everyone has an expression, emotion. And there is a search for the right position. It's not just one line. This is not a paint. This is not a drawing that has been transposed from paper. It was born right here. So that's why, in addition to being beautiful, it's so important that now we finally see it, because it's the very drawing that Leonardo created right there on the wood, on the ground layer of the support, the wood support. So now we move to the right, just to give you another example, by the way, and we go to the group of the horses and the horsemen. This is another detail, very small. You can see there are patches of brownish color there. There are rocks. You hardly see there are two horses sort of fighting each other, and there are two horsemen there. But and maybe you see a dog in between in the lower part. That's as much as you can see. But really, there is much more there. I was searching for the laser. It's okay. The laser pointer. Maybe I have it here. And now he's going to walk over and see how much you can really see there. Let me help you. First of all, out of this brown patch, there are a lot of figures there. Let me help you. See a head here? And this is his back and the knees and the legs. He's wounded. He's falling on the ground. There are a lot of different profiles here. One, two, and there is a third one here. A fourth one is here. And also this figure is trying to defend himself from a dead blow. And other horses. In other words, it's a real fight. It's a battle. It's not just a skirmish between two horses and riders. And then you see other heads of horses here. Why just the head? Because you see a line. That's a line of perspective. There are several perspective lines in this overall creation. And then let's go in order. You see here the ox and the donkey, because this is where he plays the manger that otherwise is not there. And this is the pole, and this is the roof. And there is an elephant. Why the elephant? The elephant, because he also wanted to paint Epiphany, not just the adoration. And finally, can we go to a group of figures on the left-hand side? And now, do you see this group of figures? They have been considered faded, you know, just over-cleaned, and nothing more. Okay, there's a group of faces, but really not more than that. But if we go next to it, if we walk closely, we are going to see a collection of portraits. Each of them is a masterpiece. And you see, each of them is interacting with the other. They have different expression, physiognomies. They talk to each other. They move. But this is supposed to be an adoration. That's pretty strange. An adoration normally is an aesthetic, still moment of where everybody is there adoring the infant baby, and nobody moves, nobody talks, nobody does relate with each other. Everything here is emotion. It's the first painting where emotion was introduced by Leonardo, obviously, I would say. And there are over 70 figures never seen before. So, and just imagine, you go to a museum, you pick up a painting, and you can interact this way. This is what I foresee as the beginning of a new approach to works of art. Obviously, you want to see the real thing. But don't you want also to understand how that masterpiece was created? Don't you want to see the several steps of that creation? Don't you want to know? And don't you want to understand? Because finally, you see images that you don't need somebody else to translate it for you. You just look yourself and appreciate. This is Leonardo at work. Now, you have seen those horses, okay? Now you see that it was a fighting, it was a battle scene. But that battle scene was painted, was drawn, I should say, in 1478. That is a long time before Leonardo painted the Battle of Anghiari. Now, you see the battle scene, as you've seen before, the drawing, and next to it, you see what is called the Rubens drawing of the Battle of Anghiari, or I should be more precise, of the fight for the standard. Incidentally, Rubens added color to this drawing because the drawing itself was done by an anonymous artist of the late 15th century. But you can see the similarities. And indeed, Leonardo had in mind this fighting scene and kept it. And therefore, when he had the chance, this great commission was given by the city of Florence in 1503, he introduced this just very fighting scene in the Battle of Anghiari as the most important part of the battle scene that was going to be originally as big as three times as the Last Supper. and was going to show a battle scene that went through for an entire day over a wall 60 meters long. So let's just move in fast on the search for the Belle of Anguille. This masterpiece that disappeared between 1562 and 1573, when Vasari, the Medici's architect, was commissioned to remodel the Hall of 500. And everything takes place right here in Florence, in Palazzo Vecchio, right behind the main old Palazzo Vecchio. That's why it's called Palazzo Vecchio, this part here. And now we're going to see, for the ones of you, I'm sure just about every one of you has seen this wonderful Hall of 500, and this is where the action actually takes place. So the job is, how can you locate, or how can you prove, or I should say both, if the Leonardo mural is still there, hidden somewhere behind the Vasari's mural? Well, this, just to give you an idea, we have seen this already, and this is what Michelangelo should have painted, but he never started. Some art historians say that they should have completed the preparatory cartoon, but we don't have a trace of it. We don't know how it was destroyed, and in any case, that's all we have, is this engraving. That is not, it's just a part, obviously, of the Battle of Cascina, which was another big victory of the Florentine army, in this case over the Sinese, the Pisan army, whereas the Battle of Cascina was a great victory over the Milanese army. Okay, oddly enough, I know it sounds like a curiosity, but way up here, we found a flag with Cerca Trova, search you shall find. Now, it's a coincidence, maybe. It just happens, though, that after years of research, this flag, this inscription, not only is the only inscription that is to be found in all six of those mural paintings, it's not visible from the ground floor. And indeed, it's original. In other words, we had the permission to take a small sample of the white of one letter and make a cross-section, and indeed there is no discontinuity between the green, between the white and the green of the flag. And finally, it just happens that it just sits over the area where most likely Leonardo did paint the Belle of Anguille. So that was found, by the way, in 1975. So that was the very first finding. Now, we had a major task to do a 3D architectural survey of the entire Palazzo Vecchio, and specifically of the Hall of 500. And again, with top technology and great scientists from UCSD, actually Calit2 and School of Engineering, we are now, right now, in the process of gathering this enormous 3D rendering of the Hall of 500. We will go down to a precision of 1 millimeter. And this is what you see, just a very initial rendering of 5% of all the billions of points that we have collected, shooting a laser beam and a pulse laser beam. This laser beam bounces to the object, it bounces back to you, and you measure, since you know the speed, and you can measure the time, and you can measure the time that it takes to go from the instrument to the object and come back to the instrument, and therefore you then determine the distance, and you place these dots, millions of them, billions of them actually, in space, and this is what you get. So you can then zoom in and applying also real color images over those points, and you get a rendering that is beyond the imagination of what could have been done just a few years ago. And this is technology that we are using right now. This was an early rendering of all the, it shows all the rooms have been attached from the time Leonardo painted to today. And so we had to understand which was original, which was not, but without touching anything. So how you do that? How do you know that, let's say, one part of the whole is original or has not been changed from the original state when the great whole, as it was called originally, was created at the very end of the 15th century? Well, there is a way using a thermal camera that allows you to go through plaster, even painted plaster, and see the structure of the wall. Now look at this detail. And see this. You actually see the image, the thermal image of the bricks. This is not a trick. Again, we are looking behind. Okay, as we have seen behind a layer of paint, we see behind a layer of plaster. And we see very well all the bricks and the layout of those bricks. So that's very handy. Don't think it's so simple to do, though. First of all, you have to do it by night. You have to do it when it's very cold, because you are detecting the heat emitted from the object and transforming this heat in an image. So you have to place yourself in a position when this very little heat coming from the, in this case, from a wall, can very well be re-emitted in the environment. So the environment must be colder than the surface of the wall itself. So we do it by night, and then it's not just a single shot. Even this image here, it was 15 thermograms assembly. But let me show you, we are moving closer to the end. Let me show you what else we have done. This is one of the major courtyard in Palazzo Vecchio. So let's suppose that we want to understand, because we needed to understand all the transformation that went through in Palazzo Vecchio and finally in the Hall of 500, to understand what was the original layout, architectural layout, when Leonardo walked in and started to paint, just in order to understand where to search for the Bello Vangliari, and not to be confused an area where a window could have been, or a door, or whatever else. Whatever other different layout, architectural layout was there. So now look this. We just, using thermography, we are going through that plaster layer and we see the first layout of the 1299 done by Arnolfo Di Cambio, and this is how the two images look one next to the other. You see a lot of these windows refer to the original first architectural layout. So in other words, you see a page of art, of architectural history before your eyes in real time. And that is a great boost to understand the modification the monumental buildings went through. But that's also, you have right here a very good technology and therefore a methodological approach. In the interest of conservation, you should know first before you touch anything. And red is, we managed to do this in dozens and dozens of rooms, thousands and thousands of thermograms, and finally what you see here in blue are all the added parts after the Great Hall was built at the end of 15th century, and the red is the original layout. But just to make it a sort of another walkthrough, this time it is a walkthrough that shows a rendering, but every single detail we uncovered through objective data generated by our technologies. So you might like to see this. This is a walk. We go up the staircases that we managed to locate, the original staircases. There is a document saying that once you get on top of the staircase, have a look at the wonderful horses of Leonardo. So we wanted to find those staircases. And therefore, we wanted to locate all the windows and doors, and therefore the possible location of the Bello Vangliari. So this is how it looked before Vasari actually remodeled it. Now, this is how the east wall, the one in front of you when you walk in the Hall of 500, will look like, after November 1504, because we found a document showing that the windows on that wall were filled in. So when Leonardo started to paint in early 1505, the entire wall was free for him to paint. It was a huge wall, over 62 meters. And we know now, collecting all the data that we have produced together with the documents, that this is the area where we should finally concentrate, zoom in, to determine if the Leonardo Battle of Anghiari is still there. And let me show you an assembly of thousands of thermograms, the entire 60 meters thermogram image, and to see it a little closer, so you can see how we were able to see that the lower part was indeed the original wall, and all this part was modified by Vasari, and you can see there is a total difference in layout, structural layout. And the reason is very simple. We finally understood that the original wall had a ledge at a certain height, and Vasari placed a stone wall, a stone frame on that ledge, and then he built his brick wall on top, and then he painted over the brick wall. And that's why this layout, this structure layout, is different from the lower part, as we have seen in thermography. But we knew that Vasari tried to save masterpieces when he could. So, and he did that, placing a brick wall next to the masterpiece and leaving a small air gap. So we said, maybe there is an air gap there. Maybe he has done the same thing. How do we find an air gap behind a wall, a tiny air gap? Well, we decided to use radar. And we started with ground penetrating radar, then we moved to what is called, to a different frequency and a different generation of radar pulses, and we use what is called interferometric antenna. In other words, we increase the possibility to see very small differences in the inner structure of the wall, in this specific case, searching for an air gap. And we managed to find, just behind the end of the brick wall, a very strong signal associated to an air gap, just on the right side of the east wall. Remember where there was Cerca Trova? Right there. So now, putting all the pieces together, you see the thermal images as you've seen before. Now you see the radar maps, this time collecting all the signals just behind the brick wall. Okay, so it's like if we had stripped down the brick wall, and we see what kind of signals are generated behind that wall. And indeed, there is a very strong signal concentration right here. This is the right panel of the east wall, and this is where we think the Leonardo da Vinci mural should be. So, more or less, we are at the conclusion of our talk, even though I'd like to summarize it visually here. So there is the brick wall, the air gap, and possibly the Leonardo's mural. What's next? Well, we haven't solved the problem yet. Now we know there is an air gap. It just happens to be only there, and just happened that could be very well be created by Vasari, just to protect the mural of the Leonardo. So now we are going to test. We are in the stage of testing a new technology, or I should say, a new technology applied to cultural heritage. It's called neutron activation analysis. We just send a neutron beam, and we detect gamma rays. They are being generated at different depths by different materials inside, behind that wall. We know all the pigments used by Leonardo because we found the documents specifying exactly which pigment and what was the amount of each pigment being used. So we are helped because now we know the chemical components, the chemical elements of those pigments. So this is the next step that is already started. We are in the feasibility stage now of the project. Just two words for other project we are involved. It's a very important one, and this time involves San Diego. San Diego Museum of Art, and most probably also the Timken Gallery, to do the clinical chart of a work of art. Like in a hospital, like for patients, collecting, doing all the tests, doing all the examinations, and then providing a virtual container like you will do for a real patient, so you'll know how that work of art was made, what is the state of conservation at that very moment, and then follow up with other tests, what is the decay process from that moment on. That simple concept, you will not find one single museum today in the world who has done that, who has applied that idea of the clinical chart. Obviously, there is a drawback. You might also find some works of art which are not authentic in the process, by the way. The other one, the great project we are involved, we got the permission by the authority in Florence to study the House of the Medici. Same procedure that you have shown you for the Palazzo Vecchio, we will apply to the House of the Medici. Going back in time and trying to show how this masterpiece was built and was modified throughout the centuries. This is where the Renaissance started. This is the main patron house. This is Leonardo, Michelangelo, Raphael. They all were paid by this patron, the Medici family. So I think this is a great tribute that we would like to give to Florence. At the same time, it's a great honor for us to be given this great project to do. And we also involve in the digital archaeology and specifically the Atlas of the Holy Land. And this is another major undertaking that we are doing right now. Obviously, we have a lot of other projects in mind, such as surveillance of archaeological sites through multispectral imaging, satellite imaging, and so forth. But basically, I just want to say, as I said at the very beginning, I'm very proud to have this opportunity and to have it right here where all things started for me. Thanks to Professor Walter Monk. Thanks to all the great teachers I had who taught me to think interdisciplinary, to open my mind and not just be channeled through just one single field, but search for answers everywhere that could be found. If you want to know more about what we are doing, we'll be glad to be in contact with you if you were to either pick up a brochure or leave us some reference so we can update, and we'll be glad to do so. I thank you so much for your time and your patience.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.